Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open.
Good morning. Be seated, please. Justice Sweeney is home recovering from back surgery. He will be listening to the oral arguments on tape. He's read the briefs and will be participating in all the decisions we make today. The first case is 99-286, State of Ohio versus Daniel Williams. Mr. Colson.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Jeff Colson, Lee County Prosecutor. I'd like to introduce Joe Klammer, one of my assistant prosecuting attorneys, sitting at the table. I would like to request to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal, if I may, please.
Watch your time and clock then.
I think what I'd like to just do is cut this issue right to the knife edge to what I think is the bare bones crucial thing we need to talk about. When we look at the 11th District Court of Appeals, at least the majority of the court's decision, and that is, are the registration requirements and the notice requirements under HB 180 that a sexual labeling sexual predator requiring to register and requiring the notification to the community, are they unreasonable and arbitrary? I think that's really the crucial issue. I think there are some the state legislature when it passed HB 180 said that and recognized the fact that people who commit sex crimes have a very high potential for recidivism. I think this court recognized that fact in Cook that you decided in 1998, State v. Cook, when you looked at the retroactivity part of this HB 180. And I think our common sense and our experience clearly tells us that sexual offenders have a very high rate of recidivism. And so therefore, the problem that we have with them is real and substantial and is a public health, safety, and moral issue.
Counsel, is that the way we apply the clear and convincing test that the fact that there is data that indicates that sexual persons engaged in sexual conduct, illegal sexual conduct, are likely to repeat their conduct? The clear and convincing standard, as you know, is pretty high standard for a trial court to reach in determining whether someone is likely to engage in that sort of conduct again. Here we have an adult woman who was a victim, rape victim. What sort of test should we be writing to give direction to attorneys and trial courts in determining what is clear and convincing? How does a trial judge decide whether someone's conduct is likely to be repeated a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What sort of guidelines do we need to write, if any?
Well, that is a tough question. In writing the guidelines, I think that the statute itself has some guidelines, at least things that the court must consider in making this other than leaving it to the discretion of the court and the evidence, the factual evidence that the court has to hear in determining what this particular offender's past record has been, what he did in this offense, potentially psychological evidence that could be admitted as to any testing that may or may not have been done and wants to be and can be admitted. I'm not sure that we talk about clear and convincing. I've ever read a real clear definition in any case what is absolutely clear and convincing. And when we say preponderance of the evidence, say, well, more likely than not, when you get clear and convincing, what are we talking about? Are we talking about 70%, 75%, I don't know, of the weight of where you think that this person will commit another sex crime? So it's very difficult. And I think that's what we have to rely upon, not only prosecution in making sure that they put on sufficient evidence to convince the court that there is a strong likelihood, a clear convincing likelihood that this particular defendant will commit another crime, therefore should be labeled as sexual predator, but also the discretion of the judge becomes very important. I don't know, and I have no answer for you as to what specific rules you would have to look at other than just applying through legal experience, the judges having experience in knowing what clear and convincing would be to them in this particular case based on these facts.
Would you concede that it is more subjective than objective?
I think when we're talking about any preponderance, when we're talking about any
well, we're talking about clear, and convincing. It's the same thing we go through when we weigh mitigation against aggravation in death penalty cases.
It
becomes subjective, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
And if that's the case, that's maybe why the General Assembly said there has to be a higher standard.
I agree.
Okay. We're really applying Megan's Law, aren't we, in these cases? I mean, that's really what the sexual predator thing is, had its genesis with Megan's Law.
Yes.
What was Megan's Law designed to do?
Well, it was designed to notify the community, and what I like to say, designed it somewhat put a spotlight on the defendant, so that the community knows that a sexual offender, a sexual predator, is in their community, so that the community can take any necessary action, at least increase, heighten their awareness, so that they can take whatever action is necessary to protect themselves from any further acts of the sexual predator.
Was it its genesis, or its at least declared intent to protect juveniles?
Well, Megan obviously was a juvenile, and that was the initial intent. However, as you know, HB 180 applies to all sexual offenders and not just those who commit crimes of juveniles.
You know, let me tell you what we're wrestling with, or at least what I'm wrestling with. And the chief made reference to it earlier. This is an adult woman. Crime is no less heinous, obviously, because she was very brutally raped in this case after the burglary. But when we apply the criteria set forth in the Megan's Law standard, all that I've been able to read, including the legislative intent, refers to protection of children. Now, what if you have a case like we've had where you have a man and woman having a long-time relationship, and then she alleges that he broke in or he came to her house one night and raped her? It was not consensual. He said it was consensual. He's found guilty of rape, and he's branded as a sexual predator. Is that what the law is designed for?
Well, he's not automatically designed as a sexual.
Well, after the hearing, the judge, and we've seen very few where the judge has not found the defendant any sex crime to be a sexual predator. Isn't that fair?
That's
okay.
True.
I mean, that's true, not necessarily fair. So he has all the notification requirements. Wherever he goes for the rest of his life, everybody in the neighborhood has to know that he had this encounter with his friend a long period of time ago. Is that what the law was designed for? That's, you know, it might very well be, and I just wanted to know what your thoughts are.
I believe the law is written that way. Yes, sir. And I think there's a good reason for that. Obviously, we want to protect children, but we have to also protect the adults. I don't think that a sex crime, it makes any real difference. If we want to protect children, we can also protect the adults. So I don't see any real basic distinction there in the notification, why it would make any difference.
Okay, then what would the rationale be that we don't say that whenever somebody has been convicted of murder, gets out in 10 years, that we notify the community you have a murderer in your midst?
I think it goes back to the recidivism rate and you know,
you're more likely.
As a prosecutor, I've never seen a person commit one sex crime. I think this is a fact of life. I think this is a real, this is an issue that the legislature recognized. I think this is an issue that, quite frankly, is a matter of common sense, and that the recidivism rate is extremely high, and that's not necessarily so with murderers. But the legislature, when addressing this issue, said we recognize that you know, sex crimes, especially since they can be, I'm paraphrasing you, that it's done in secret, you know, it's not done open in the public. Well, I suppose a lot of crimes aren't. But in this case, I think when somebody does a sex crime, the chances of them committing it again is so great that the legislature wants to take this additional action, and I think that the action they took is clearly not unreasonable or arbitrary.
If the legislature wanted this to be applied across the board to the children and adults, why then would they have had one of the factors to be considered the age of the victim of the sexually oriented offense? Why would they mention that?
Well, because I think if you talk about the age of the victim, but, and I think that's where the judge has to look at. That's one of the things where the judge has to look at in trying to decide, is this person likely to commit, clear convincing evidence, to commit another sex crime? And that's just one criteria to look at. I think if you look at all the sentencing criteria, oftentimes age is put in there. So I don't think that the clear intent that this should only apply to juveniles at all.
Because before the legislature would have certainly known how to take this only applies to children under 15 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
And actually, in their statement of purpose, the General Assembly said for persons to protect themselves and their children, so perhaps the General Assembly was thinking beyond adults, beyond children.
I think when you look at, in fact, what is 22-02, when you look at the intent of the legislation and the findings that they make, it clearly says that. If I may, I'd like to save the remaining time I have for rebuttal unless there's another question.
Thank you.
Good morning. I have enough for that night to assist my time public defender to represent Daniel Williams. With me is Paul Plant, the Lake County public defender. One of the first questions you asked Mr. Colton was the clear and convincing guidelines and exactly what that entails and what does that mean. And I think that it certainly Justice Douglas brought to our attention that in reality, for many judges, perhaps the guidelines, while they may be there, and that's certainly something the judge would look at, the reality of the situation for judges in terms of predicting future dangerousness is very difficult, certainly for judges elected. Sit there and determine whether or not, hold the crystal ball to whether or not this offender is ever going to offend again is something that's difficult for psychologists to predict, let alone the judges. So the reality of the situation are that, yes, the majority of people who do come before the court are being found sexual predators. Certainly in Lake County, we are very anxious for the court to make its ruling on the constitutionality of the statute so that our appellate court, one way or the other, start taking a look on a case-by-case basis at the number of people who are being labeled sexual predators. Many of them were committed on one offense. Mr. Colton referred to the fact that in 25 years of prosecuting, it's his experience that sexual predators repeat the same crime over and over again. I would disagree with that and say the legislature disagrees with that. The reason we know that is because they gave up classifications for these offenders. Sexual predator, sexual offender, habitual sexual predator, and so forth. The legislature itself, while they may point to recidivism rate, certainly doesn't make up. I don't think Mr. Colton do that once a predator, always a predator, once an offender, always a predator. If that were the case, we wouldn't have a need for a hearing, nor would we have a need for these guidelines. Justice Douglas, you asked whether or not this is Megan's Law, and Mr. Colton suggests. This is Ohio's version, perhaps, of Megan's Law, but it differs very much from Megan's Law. I was down here a few months ago for the argument in Nagali, and I know that Nagali brief discussed at great length the difference between Ohio's law, sexual predator law, versus New Jersey or New York, which has been upheld by their Supreme Court. And there are big differences. One of them is this perhaps overbroad notification plan that we have in Ohio's law. This notification plan that hurts people, particularly like Mr. Williams, who has never been known to offend against a child, who at a very young age was convicted of raping a woman, and who has spent nearly 20 years in prison and most likely will spend his entire 25-year sentence there. Yet when he gets out, if there's a hearing in this case and he's labeled a predator, everybody in the community, all of his neighbors, the school children, the daycare centers, people perhaps that have no reason to fear Mr. Williams will be told that he is a predator and they are to look out for him. And that is the problem and the difference between Ohio's quote, Megan's Law versus New Jersey or New York.
Is there any other state that, I think there's a reference in one of the cases today, a listing of the different statutes in the various states. Is there any state that has a notification system that is as broad, comprehensive as Ohio that you know of?
Not that I know of, Judge. And I think that's a major part of the Williams position is the fact that so many of Mr. Williams' right to be in Texas be labeled a senator because of his overall notification. Also, the other Megan's laws do not have any of the vigilante, they have the vigilante warning that our law doesn't have. Certainly in Ohio law, if somebody is to commit a crime and that's an offender, we have criminal statutes to deal with that. But I think the other states recognize that there is this potential, very potential effect of harm on the offenders from those states in the vigilante warnings.
Counsel, of course, we start with a strong presumption of constitutionality, and you know that, and then we have a couple arguments. One, that this is a non-self-executing provision of the Constitution. And even if we go beyond that argument, then we have what we apply as a rational basis sort of test rather than what appears to be a strict scrutiny test as applied by the 11th District Court of Appeals. Maybe you could address that particularly. Why this would not meet a rational basis review for constitutionality?
I think the confusion over the standards comes with the use of the Frohlich versus Cleveland case, certainly. But the 11th District intended to use the Frohlich case to define what sometimes an imprecise term, what is reasonable, what is not reasonable. Mm-hmm. And in Frohlich, this court in 1919 set up a standard what you can use to determine what's reasonable or not. And while it does have some of the words that encroach upon the strict scrutiny standard, it doesn't quite rise to that level. And those words that the 11th District Court of Appeals used would be that it interfered with the private rights beyond the necessities of the situation in this case. And again, they go to the overbroadness of the law. And also that it's unduly oppressive upon individuals. While those words, again, may come close to strict scrutiny, I think this court in Frohlich establishes that you can use this standard when you're dealing with a reasonableness test.
The Benjamin test, on the other hand, is a more recent and seems pretty obviously a rational basis test. Why wouldn't we? Why is Frohlich more appropriate here? I mean, we don't have a suspect class. You know, is it intermediate scrutiny that Frohlich uses? And why would this merit that sort of scrutiny?
Again, the 11th District began with the Benjamin test, and the second part being whether or not the law is unreasonable or arbitrary, and then tied Frohlich in for the definition of reasonableness.
Yeah.
But I think it's sort of a little different to use in this case when the court has to look at this law and how it affects individuals and come up with a way to explain to all of us why would it be reasonable, and that's where encroaching upon liberty is coming into play. There is much said in the brief, both the Amherst brief and our brief in response to the state about whether or not self-executing provision. Certainly we argue that it is self-executing, according to Davis versus Burke, 1900 United States case. When a constitution asserts a certain right or lays down a certain principle of law and so forth, it means that it be self-executing. And certainly to me, the whole Section 1, Article 1, speaking of our individual rights to defend life and liberty, firing, possessing property, and so forth. Those are certainly laying down certain rights. They speak for themselves. We all understand what they mean. Our case law for years has understood what they mean. And so now for the state and attorney general to come in and say, we're not really quite sure what you're talking about in that provision, it would be quite fair, I think, to present it to the court this way.
But you can't deny that persons who have been convicted of crime have a reduced expectation to these rights?
No, not at all. And it's established by case law, certainly the reduced expectation of privacy as it relates to their reputation and notification and others' awareness of whether or not they committed a crime. But I think one day,
and they also lose certain rights after they've been convicted of crime.
Certainly, and I think there's two certain distinctions that need to be made. One is as to whether or not what rights they use, and the state detailed a list of all of the things in our state that put limitations on, quote, criminals. For example, if you have a show homicide, you're limited in your right to drive. And that makes sense. Those tie in very tightly together. It would make sense that it's very limited. The sexual predator law and the impact on this individual's rights, though, is so far spread, the accumulation of all the impacts that make it.
So the studies that have been made in this area certainly establish that these types of individuals who commit these crimes, there's a great recidivism among them.
And I think the same would be true for car thieves. So the question then is, should all of us be warned that car thieves are in the neighborhood so that we can protect our cars a little more vigilantly than we already are doing for our children? And the legislature obviously has not made those laws, and there's very clear reasons for not doing that.
That involves property, this is certainly in this situation.
Well, our argument is this too involves property. And obviously, that's in Article 1, Section 1, that individuals, because the effects of the law, are losing the rights that they have to own property. They're being, and we read about in the papers every day, they're being burned out of homes, their crops are being put in their yards, they're not, the neighbors are collecting money so that they can outbid somebody on property so that they don't get a post-sexual predator in their home. So I think it does affect beyond reputation, it affects property, it affects their ability to get jobs and hold jobs.
But does the, as in Cook, this court held that the harsh consequences, you know, when we held that it wasn't punishment, the harsh consequences arise from the conduct, you know, the crime, rather than from the effects of the law. And that's a sort of a hard concept to sort out, whether these difficult situations that these offenders would find themselves in result from their conduct or from the notification.
With all due respect, I disagree with that premise, Cook. And the reason for that is that, yes, individuals such as Mr. Williams have certain societal consequences. It doesn't suffer anybody. And he has already suffered these. You know, his own embarrassment that he has felt in his family. His strength from his family, lost his property because they went to prison. All that together, and Mr. Williams certainly expects that. What he doesn't expect is the government to almost, to him, swoop down on him when he comes out of prison, gathering all the information that's there, putting it out for the public. So certainly, this information is public, but there's a difference between an individual going to a courthouse and looking something up on his story versus the government assembling it for him.
Right.
So I think it's not so much his past action, but the government's action in bringing this back to power.
Well, in actually making that reputation that we would agree that the offender would already suffer. The reputation issues, he would already suffer, but the government makes that, rather than let that die, we let the community continue to know about that.
That's right.
Okay.
But it goes beyond reputation, and I know that's what Cook addressed, the damages to his reputation.
Yeah, you're saying that there could be a kind of active conduct on the part of the community members that intimidate and set it.
Yes, and the government brings that about, helps bring that about by the overall notification.
Is there a missing step there, though? The government says, here's the facts on an individual. That notification prompts people to do, you know, is there a step missing in what the government really did? If someone comes and puts a cross in someone's yard.
Certainly the government didn't encourage that, encouragement. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, again, it goes back to the concerns raised with, for example, Mr. Williams. Why should the school know about Mr. Williams who's never harmed a child? Why should the daycare centers be concerned about Mr. Williams?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the stuff that's missing is the problem we're complaining about, is that it's not tailored enough in the situation that it is.
Counselors, there's a step missing for me, too, and I've let it go on now for some time. We've talked about the merits we did with Mr. Coulson, but I need to take you back to the procedure because this case doesn't come, at least as I see it, to us in the proper posture, and I need you to straighten that out. Mr. Williams was convicted. He's in prison. The authorities say we should have a sexual predator hearing. They schedule it. The trial court dismisses all of the charges. Am I correct? Okay. It says has nothing to do because the statute's unconstitutional. The state appeals that. The Court of Appeals, by majority vote, said it's unconstitutional. Now it's before us, and we're talking about the merits of a case vis-a-vis Mr. Williams, who has never been involved with this. Is it properly before us?
I think it is in that I don't know that we're ever going to encounter an individual before their labels who can tell you what their effects individually on them will be.
But very well, the trial court might find him not to be a sexual predator when he finally does have his hearing, if we find it constitutional.
That's sure that this court, if you found the statute constitutional, you didn't address the concerns raised in Williams and Brooks County, at least to decide that Article 1, Section 1, it would still be unconstitutional. So you would never have this hearing.
I mean, usually you find it, maybe we'll use another case as the lead case in it, but you usually find somebody who has suffered the disability, the penalty, being the appellant. And here we have somebody who has suffered, quote, nothing to this point, vis-a-vis the law. I recognize he wouldn't think that, but he certainly has not suffered the penalties yet. There's been no notification, everybody, about him. And yet we're going to make a merit decision on that for him. So it seems to me if we find the law constitutional, it doesn't affect him in either way, does it? Until it comes time, if they then hold a hearing?
Well, I would ask the court not to respectfully vary its kind of standards to the effect of this law that has been felt. Certainly Mr. Williams can't build a record for that because he hasn't been labeled prisoner and not released. But this court has before it the Gowdy brief and the amicus brief in that case, mm-hmm. which details the effects. I refer to them in my brief citing other case law. And so it seems it needs to be addressed at this point. To send it back and not rule on it, we're not getting any order. We're spinning our wheels. And while the state may say that, well, the effects we're talking about are merely speculative, we found it not to be the case. It's just the evidence presented in other cases before this court, in our case. And the common knowledge, too, is the court has from reading the newspapers and reading what's happening.
Who are the two affected parties in this case? We usually have a case or controversy adversary, don't we? Who are the two parties? The only people we have here are the states saying it's constitutional.
Well, I think Mr. Williams certainly is affected if it's ruled unconstitutional. If it's ruled constitutional,
not yet he isn't.
He has to be labeled.
No, he doesn't have to be labeled. He has to be labeled after a hearing. Labeled if there is a hearing. And if it finds. Okay.
It has to be labeled with one category, either habitual sexual offender, predator, or other.
You haven't argued this, but is there some prejudice to him even being exposed to the hearing?
Being exposed to the
hearing is determined whether he's, what category he falls in.
Sure, there is no, and it's not certainly not part of the record, but I can tell you, to a meeting with Mr. Williams, ironically, this case is here and will receive much publicity. And Mr. Williams is one of those people who went to prison feeling guilty for 25 years, days that's deciding, hopefully, quietly fade into the background, and that's certainly won't happen.
Would exposing him to a hearing be a final appealable order? Wouldn't be, would it?
Yes, it would be. The actual hearing in the trial court?
No, exposing him to the hearing. Scheduling the hearing.
No, he is attorney.
Clearly he wouldn't be.
Thank you. Mr. Colson, you say about 4.5 minutes to the time.
Hey, I just want to briefly pick up where you just left off, Justice Douglas, and Chief Justice Moyer. The effect, in your ruling, the effect on Williams is he would have a predator hearing, where at this point we have been prevented from having the sexual predator hearing and that's it. But what I really want to focus on, if I may, just for a moment, is this notification and how it's characterized as overbroad. We have an individual who, in Williams, in this particular case, who committed a rape, he's a rapist, he committed a burglary, he's a burglar. He went to prison. In fact, he self-confessed rapist and burglar. He pled guilty. And when he comes out, what the government will do, if this is held constitutional, and he is determined to be a predator after the hearing, after clear and convincing evidence, following the guidelines and the statute to assure that abuse is not made, he will be declared to be a sexual predator, and then the government will then notify the community of his public record. I don't see how this hurts his reputation. I know the majority of the 11th District Court of Appeals said that this is hurting his reputation. Quite frankly, I don't think he has much of a reputation that can be hurt, but that's not the issue here. The issue is we want to protect the other people. This is a man who has hurt other people before, and we want to make sure that the community around him knows it. And I think that is unreasonable or arbitrary need of the police power. When we look at the constitutional provision that the Court of Appeals relied upon in creating this privacy right, I don't really want to go into with it, because I don't think that's really important. The issue is, if there is this total privacy right in the Section 1 of Article 1 of the Constitution, it certainly has to be modified by the police power. We all understand that. And so the police power in this case goes to protecting the safety and a real and substantial relationship to the public health and safety. And it gets down to, is this unreasonable? I would like to ask the court to review again Judge Ford's dissenting decision, because I think it is really a well-written, a very good, short, succinct decision. What he's saying is the Ohio Medicaid law is not a perfect law. It has some problems with it. But those problems do not rise to a constitutional violation. Clearly, if there's no proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this law is unconstitutional.
Counsel?
Yes, sir. Excuse me.
In your experience so far, just looking at adult cases, let's do that outside, are you finding that the majority of the cases in which only one sexual crime has been committed are found to be writing the guidelines for trial judges on jurisprudence in terms of the issue? When you have somebody who raped an ex-girlfriend, and that's the only crime they ever committed, putting that sexual offender category, is that what the law really was intended to do?
Well, I'm not. It depends upon the facts of that particular case. And if it's setting like
your facts are only one sexual crime committed against an adult, and that's it, and judges are likely finding that to be a sexual predator. But we're finding anything to be a sexual predator, a sexual crime here.
I disagree with you. I get referred to my office cases all the time from the prison authority saying we should hold a sexual predator hearing. I review them. If I don't feel that they are sexually oriented offense, or if there wasn't sexual motivation involved, I don't proceed if we don't look for that. When we go into courts, the fact that the majority...
But if there is a sexually oriented offense, even though it's one, you are hearing, right? And you're sending to a hearing.
Not... Yes, Your Honor. Yes. If we are sending it...
One rape committed, this is what I refer to, you're sending to a sexual predator.
That's correct. That's correct. And then you have to look at the facts of that case. It could be that and the judge has to look at the facts of that case. I don't think that we want to, and I hear from the questions being asked of me, that this court maybe is considering some guidelines, and I hadn't thought of that before we got here today, and maybe that might be something that would be good, but I think what you have to look at, and what is the primary importance is, that particular case, the actions of that defendant in that case. It could be where it's a long time, a situation where they're dating and she has claimed rape and the jury found that the fact there was rape involved. That may or may not be a sexual predator, but also it could be he'd been stalking her, they had broken up, it could be something very violent, and he is a sexual predator. So I don't think we can say just because there's been only no prior, or there's only one time, that we shouldn't look at that as a sexual predator. The mere fact that most of...
Congress also be true that if there is nothing else, no stalking, no other violence, just the rape, the judges are finding that to be sexual predator, is that proper? That's the proper application. Nothing else, no stalking, no other violence, nothing else about the one rape, finding the rape.
Down there, I'm very kind of thinking there might be a rape condition, but if there is a rape condition, in order to get to the rape condition, and when you have those kind of cases, it's looked at for the genocide by every prosecutor I've ever known. It's looked at very for the genocide by the jury in every case I've ever known. So when we get to that conviction part, we have gotten to the part where it is clear from judges that there's enough evidence to go to the jury that in fact this person committed a rape. And so
I guess in more than simple terms, with one rape a professional
person. It could, yes.
Now the hidden history.
Yes. And based upon my personal experience and the literature that that I have reviewed, you know, when you get to the rate, the chances of recidivism on something that violent against an individual is so great.
When the judge is making this determination of a sexual predator, he's certainly considering more than simply the crime.
Yes.
He has before him
yes,
the
yes.
entire probation report, the background of this individual, all those kind of things we take into consideration.
That's absolutely correct. And maybe
so we shouldn't make the hard, we shouldn't, or couldn't make, shouldn't make a hard and fast rule simply because someone has committed only one rape, they would not be a sexual predator.
I agree wholeheartedly with you, Honor. I think what we have to do is make sure we look at each case. And I think that was alluded to by the public defender just a few minutes ago in saying, well, we want to have a sexual predator hearing so that we can appeal them. And say, obviously, if the judge has abused the discretion, that is open to review. Hopefully that won't happen. But there is anything. The judge is fined by clear convincing evidence based upon the facts presented to the court, creating a record that in fact there is a strong likelihood this person will commit another sex offense before they're labeled predator. And that is reviewable.
Counsel, on your experience, and I hate that we're asking a lot about your experience, and we shouldn't decide cases based upon the experience of one prosecutor, but it is helpful to have us see practically how the statute is working, I guess. Are you seeing, how does a trial judge, I'm still interested in how a trial judge makes his or her decision on it, because of the cases, frankly, because of the cases we've seen, the Gowdy, for example. How a trial judge makes a decision that someone is likely to commit these kinds of offenses in the future. Is there usually psychological, are there usually psychological reports from somebody who is qualified to predict that kind of conduct, or is it just based upon the record and the judge's sort of subjective feelings, as Justice Douglas suggests?
There isn't always psychological. Sometimes there is. Sometimes there's a history there. Sometimes it's in the pre-sentence report. Sometimes it's there. Sometimes there is no psychological, Your Honor. What the judge is looking at the factors, from my experience, he's looking at the factors listed in the statute in HB 180, applying them to the facts of this case.
The factors in 180, as you have to admit, a number of the factors in 180 don't have a thing to do with future
sure.
conduct. Age of the victim and a number of them don't have anything to do with age or predictability. We're predicting future conduct is something that's not very easy for any of us to do. And I would think that in these cases particularly, there would need to be some expert testimony that indicates this person's mind is going like this, and this is going to cause him or her to continue this kind of conduct. You don't see that as routine evidence. Let's see if you can answer.
I don't have that answer, and I see what you're grappling with, and it is true that if there is no psychological, sometimes you get psychological going both ways, and sometimes, you know, psychological is a testimony or evidence or your testing is not all that inclusive. What the judge is also looking at, though, is the particular facts of this case. But, you know, we are saying,
that's my question. Let me finish, please. If there's no question, I mean, I'm not talking about the case where there's a pattern, you know, three or four attacks on juveniles, or even on adult women. That's different. But we're seeing cases where there's simply one incident, adult woman, and in the other case, there was a relationship between the two of them. Now he's a sexual predator. My question is, how do we look at these cases and decide whether the system is working the way it's supposed to work? That is, whether everybody's being treated fairly, the victims in the neighborhood and the daycare center, and the defendant, who certainly has some interest in this and has some rights in this, not to just be sort of swept up in a reaction to sexual attacks on children, about which we are all concerned. But we have to be certain at this court that the law is not overreacting to a situation, and in the overreaction that the rights of persons are not being eliminated or diminished.
Well, that's a legitimate concern, and I agree with you. It is. My only answer I have to you is that if a judge would declare somebody to be a sexual predator, and there were no evidence of at all of there being or scant evidence of his being a reoffender, then I think that would be a right case for reversal on appeal. I would think that when we're looking at weighing clear convincing, there has to be something in the record for the judge to rely upon. And not the scenarios that have been given to me by you are cases in which, you know, you're cutting right. I'm used to dealing with cases where there are many facts involved that we look at and the judge is looking at to make a decision. If you boil it down to simply a date rape type thing or a living type and no other evidence whatsoever the judge makes that decision, then maybe there isn't clear convincing evidence and he shouldn't make that decision. But I seldom see cases that it's that crystal clear, that boiled down.
Challenge.
I'm sorry?
This is a facial challenge. I mean, the court took it facially as unconstitutional.
That's correct.
So it doesn't matter. As applied, it's a different issue.
That's correct. In fact, this issue wasn't even brought up in the trial court.
I know that.
So that
or even in the court,
that would not matter even if the particular defendant here has put the statute in terms of having demonstrated the pattern.
That's true.
And the reason we're having a problem applying it is because we don't have any facts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
We don't know whether he's a sexual predator or not vis-a-vis the trial judge and or the Court of Appeals.
We haven't been allowed to get to that point.
You've been way over your time, and I suppose I shouldn't contribute to it, but and the Chief made a good point that we shouldn't be judging just on one prosecutor's experiences. But I, too, am curious. When you say we should bring all of these cases and judge it case by case, how many sexual predator hearings have you held?
Well, I'm going to have to guess, Your Honor. It would be a pretty reasonable guess.
10, 15, 20?
See, our problem is...
10, 15, 20?
No. We've got 30 of them on appeal. And
I wonder how many sexual predator hearings you've had, just an approximate number.
I would guess we're in the area of 50,
okay.
75.
Have you ever, in any one of those, found the trial judge not saying sexual predator?
No, Your Honor, but I did refuse to pursue some of those because I didn't think they were sexual predator. I mean, well, I didn't bring those. I brought the ones that I thought were weak. You know, we didn't pursue.
Now, wait a minute. I asked you how many actual hearings you've had.
Oh, actual hearings, okay. No, in all of the actual hearings...
Every one of them, the trial judge has found sexual predator status. Every one.
Okay, no, that's okay. Because there are sometimes when we get notice, and we go to the judge... you, I can say, Judge, we don't need a hearing because we are pursuing this essential principle.
The hearing,
yes, we
counsel.
Actually have a hearing, everyone. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And see, that's the thing the Chief and I were exploring with you, that the subjective versus the objective. And I can understand trial judges saying, after hearing any information about this at all, yep, statute provides for sexual predator, notify him, go back to jail.
But I don't think this is a strong thing to look at, Your Honor, because it's this. Just like, you know, prosecutors, they say, well, they spend 98% of the cases, but because we don't try people who we think are,
yeah, I understand,
are innocent, you know, we go after those who we think are guilty. Same thing with the sexual predator. When you ask me the hearings, we're not pursuing those if we don't think they're there either. You know, we're saying to the judge, you don't need a hearing, we're not pursuing this.
Well, of course, we don't know from this record, but it appears that there was here one incident.
That's correct.
Now, I understand the exacerbating circumstances of burglary and that sort of thing, but we only know of one sexual incident, and yet you brought that hearing.
That's correct. That's correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. The advice of our opinion.